Welcome to Audio Commentary Track 1 for License to Kill. I'm John Cork of the Ian Fleming Foundation, and I will be your host as we hear from director John Glenn and many members of his cast, including Carrie Lowell, Robert Davi, Benicio del Toro, David Hedison, and Desmond Llewellyn. The stories which you are about to hear reflect personal recollections and opinions of those who provided the interviews. They are not meant to provide the definitive history of the film. On Audio Commentary Track 2, you can hear a different perspective from many members of the production crew. Let's begin by hearing from Carrie Lowell, who remembers how it felt to join Cubby Broccoli and his crew on his 16th James Bond film.
There's a hierarchy that Cubby very much honors in terms of his employees, in that if you've been in the company long enough, your career does move up the ladder. And it's a really, I think, probably a very safe environment for a lot of people. And you can tell it when you're on the set. There are so many old friends that have been working on the films for so many years. In terms of just the operators and the gaffers and the grips and things like that, they really have a history together. John Glenn, he used to be an editor, and then he was a second unit director, and then he became a director. He had so many pieces to put together. It was a big challenge, and I think he did a great job.
Lowell's perception of director John Glenn is echoed by actor Robert Davi.
John Glenn, great sense of humor, very relaxed, great dry wit. I enjoyed working with him. I did a couple of films with him. He liked sending people up. He loved being the director of the Bond films, John Glenn. Great guy. Easy to talk to, and I think underrated in a lot of aspects.
Benicio del Toro is the youngest member of the cast of License to Kill. He remembers working with director Glenn.
John Glenn allowed me to be part of this great series. You know, he was the director. You know, was very much into getting the action sequence going. He knew the actions were very important for this film, and some of those action sequences in License to Kill are pretty good. And he allowed you to explore, maybe change a little bit here and there. And a gentleman, you know. Good man.
No. No, Franz. I didn't mean any harm.
The way I prepared for Sanchez in License to Kill, first off, when I get a script, I say, well, what is the character? Where is he from? What does he do for a living? And Sanchez right away was Colombian. He was part of the cartel. And I went to find out what these guys were like. Also, what being Colombian is. I remember learning some, getting in touch with someone who was from Colombia, from Medellin, and started learning a little bit of the music, the cumbia music that they had, some of the culture, the food, the language. They have a phrase, familia pues hombre. They have a certain kind of style of phrase that's different to them. So immersing myself in the cumbia music, that local music, to start get a rhythm about him, and then the language, away from the script. And then it was dissecting a little bit of that. I also met with someone who built one of the homes of Ochoa, these huge palatial mansions, and I got some of the inside scoop on what they were like, what their habits were, some of the local folklore stories and traditional stories. So I got into the culture, what they were like, and different stories, and some of the behavior, and some of the human aspects of what the character was, and then apply it to the characterization.
One of Davi's skills as an actor is his facility with accents. For this film, Davi went through a thorough process to make sure his accent was completely seamless.
They had my lines translated into the Colombian and then learned them in that language, not by memory, but so I would have a sound of it. And then I took away that and left a subtle part of the accent because we decided not to be too, because otherwise it's caricaturish. But I'm pleased because a lot of the South Americans still think I was, they thought I was from Colombia, you know, or you're Colombian or something.
Davi's role hit close to home when he found himself in Brazil during the film's opening.
Well, I was in the Amazon rainforest doing a film called Amazon, and the Bond film just opened up in Brazil. And I was in Manaus, which is Roraima, northern part of Brazil. someone came to me and said, and I felt like I was, you know, I mean, doing the Bond film opening up in Brazil. I mean, it was all over the place, and I could have been Marlon Brando for anyone. You know, here I am, really not that stature, but the Bond film brings you to an international thing. It has such a appeal to it. Someone says, someone would like to meet you, and happen to be one of these Medellin cartel guys that live in Manaus, outside, were hiding out outside of Manaus. And that was a funny experience, interesting experience.
Scenes for the first half of the film were shot in Key West in August of 1988. Director John Glenn recalls the pleasures and challenges of the location.
Yeah, shooting in Key West was a very pleasurable experience. We didn't go at the peak tourist season, so, you know, accommodation was difficult to get. But some lovely hotels down there. Beautiful situation, and somehow it suits a Bond film, you know, with the causeway that goes out, and I think it goes on for about 100 miles or something. It's an incredible area, and of course we use the disused causeway at the bridges. We use that, the bit that was disused, we were able to use, which was good. It had lots of things going for it. The islands we were using in the, you know, in the movie were very adjacent. We did run aground a couple of times, coming back at night from location. I remember we got stranded till about 3 o'clock in the morning. We were all going too fast. I think we were doing about 60 miles an hour in these boats getting back, and suddenly we missed the channel and we were aground. They had crocodiles there. I remember playing golf one of my rare days off. I decided to have play a game of golf, and went to this golf course, a municipal golf course. They made us very welcome, and my wife was traveling with me, and she was at the top of her backswing, and this crocodile leapt out of the water right behind her. And she said, "What do I do?" And I said, "Hit the thing." I meant the golf ball, not the crocodile.
Here we are at the climax of the James Bond pre-title sequence. This teaser is notable not just for the amazing aerial stunt work by Jake Lombard, but also for how it sets up the film we are about to see. Quickly, the filmmakers break many conventions of a Bond film. First, James Bond is not on a mission, nor is he gambling at a casino or lounging in the arms of a beautiful woman, the typical places we tend to find 007. Nowhere in the series up until this point do we see Bond in a situation of civilian social obligation. But all that has changed. John Glenn, Michael Wilson, Richard Maybaum, and Timothy Dalton have decided to break the iconic figure of Bond and release the human being beneath. Here in this universe, Bond is fallible, prone to anger. His quips are delivered through clenched teeth. He wrestles with mixed emotions and questions his actions. Here in this story, Bond's gadgets are nearly useless, and eventually the filmmakers strip away his license to kill and his 00 number. It is a daring move, which for many fans of Ian Fleming's novels, brings Bond closer to the original concept of the character than any other film. Now back to director Glenn, and one Bond film staple which remained unchanged for this film, the distinctive, sexy title sequence, designed by Maurice Binder.
Well, Maurice Binder, again, was part of the Bond myth. I mean, it's just like, you know, without Maurice Binder, the titles somehow, the film wouldn't seem the same. He always was very close to the mark. You know, he used to have to put Vaseline on the lens of the camera to hide the forbidden bits of a woman's body, you know. He was well known for that. We used to pull his leg about it, and he was a very disorganized character. He was an artist, and it was very frustrating for the production team sometimes when we were getting close to the release date and we still hadn't seen any titles, and he was always in the cutting room with different color pieces of perspex, looking at this and this and this and experimenting, and we were saying, "Come on, Morris, you know, we've got to get cracking, you've got to put something down." It's a very difficult thing because he didn't have a script to work with. He kind of worked his own. He was an artist. He didn't really let anyone else know what he was doing. And it was very, very difficult at times. But beneath all this, he was an artist. And what he produced in the end was so right. And it was, more importantly for his point of view, it was so late coming that you couldn't change it. And I quite often think that that's the reason why he used to hang around for so long, so that by the time you got the titles, there wasn't time to make any changes. But it used to give people grey hairs, you know, just to you know, pester him all the time, and quite often we would make 1,800 prints and have to physically cut all the titles onto each print separately because his stuff was so late. In the blink of an eye, I'll be there.
Actor David Hedison, who originally played Felix Leiter in Live and Let Die, remembers the rigors of shooting in Key West with his co-star, Grandel Bush.
Grand Bush and his girlfriend, I remember. We used to sit around, and when we were finished filming, we'd sit by the hotel, and my wife and I would get on this little sailboat. We would get on there that you'd rent, you know, and we'd go off into the distance. And they and Grand and his girlfriend would call us Bing Crosby and Grace Kelly. They said, "Oh, here's Bing and Grace." You know, we had such laughs over that. But it was such a wonderful feeling, you know, getting here. It was, you know, Key West, and it was so beautiful. These lovely sunsets. You get in the sailboat and off you'd go. Oh, it was glorious. I loved the best time.
A nice private cell waiting for your ass.
We were put at this great little guest house that was sort of an old Victorian home that had been converted into like 6 rooms or something, and they had a pool, and I spent a lot of time there on my time off. Weather was beautiful. The place that I was staying was beautiful. I think I got more sun than I should have. And because I remember getting really tan, and they were all saying, "Don't get so tan. Use your sunscreen. Put on a hat." Because I had to match, you know, the continuity, I couldn't be too tan. So I did have to stay indoors a bit while I was down there. I just remember that wig, trying to get that wig to look like it was real. It was an odd orange color that didn't really... Sorry. It just was weird, but everybody was really nice. It was a very small scene, and I just remember that everybody went out of their way to try to make me feel relaxed and comfortable.
Switch that thing off.
David Hedison, I only really saw... he was there the first day I was shooting because I had to do this. My first day on the set was with David and Timothy. And he was just very sweet. I mean, he's been around a long time, wonderful actor. And I just remember him trying to make me feel relaxed because I'm sure I was a little tense.
Movie fans remember David Hedison as the star of the 1958 classic The Fly. Hedison also starred in one of the early Cold War spy shows on television, Five Fingers. He co-starred with his friend Roger Moore on The Saint, as well as in the films Folks, The Naked Face, and his previous Bond outing. But he was unfamiliar with Timothy Dalton.
Well, you know, I didn't know Timothy before this film. And on the plane, even, he was on the other side of the cabin, I sort of waved to him. And the first day, it was rather unfortunate because, you know, I was shooting in Maine. I was doing another play in Maine. A new play by Bernard Slade called Return Engagements. And we were there, and we were doing this New England tour. And I called my agent and I said, "Listen, I have to be in Mexico City, you told me, on a specific date. I don't have a script yet." So he said, "Oh, well, I'll get you a script." No script. So finally, it was like 3 days before I had to go to Mexico City. No script. And I thought to myself, well, gee, that's very strange, because I love to have a script beforehand, sort of live with it, think about the character, think about the first scene. Then I thought to myself, well, it's probably because There's lots of running shots, you know, in and out of scenes and all of that. So I figured, well, that's probably what it is. So I get down there, and the day before I was to shoot, I look at the work schedule, I grab somebody's script, Mrs. Broccoli, Dana Broccoli's script, and I looked at the scene. It was about a 4 or 5 page dialogue sequence with Timothy. And Dana said, well, don't you have a script? I said, no, I didn't get one. And she gave me her script. So I ran up to my room, read the script, tried to, you know, remember these lines and try to think of something creative to do with them. So I get on the set, and I just really felt awful. And, you know, and Timothy was wonderful because, you know, I would blow a line or I wasn't sure of something. And I never mind the lines. I couldn't even get a thing on what I was going to do with Felix. Do you understand? I couldn't get an adjustment to the character. I felt so badly about it. And the scene was shot. It was okay. But I see that today. I see that scene. I thought, oh, God, it's not good. It's not good. I always felt guilty about it.
This scene takes place on a strip of U.S. 1, which links the Florida Keys from Key Largo to Key West. This legendary highway has hosted filmmakers from John Huston to James Cameron. Cameron filmed his own version of The Impossible Escape on the road 2 years after the Bond team left. He was shooting his spy yarn, True Lies, which also had Peter Lamont as a production designer. Robert Davi remembers shooting his escape from the armored car.
I had to learn to scuba dive for that. I knew that that was going to be a sequence, so I then started taking lessons in my pool so I'd be able to at least have a knowledge of underwater stuff. And then that was fun, you know, having to change this and then swim off and away. I thought that was a pretty cool escape. I felt like Harry Houdini for a few minutes.
While Davi escapes, we have the chance to look at the development of the story through the character of Felix Leiter. The opening of the film is set up in part to reintroduce the audience to Mr. Leiter, who appears in about half of the Ian Fleming Bond novels and 7 of the films. A problem for audiences, though, is that filmmakers never stuck with one actor from movie to movie. Here David Hedison repeats the role he played 16 years earlier in Live and Let Die, a film with a markedly different tone. In that film, starring Roger Moore, Hedison's Leiter is a likable but comic figure who seems resigned to watching Bond swoop in like a tornado, only to leave dear old Felix to pick up the pieces. Here, Bond and Felix have a deep friendship, absent comic undertones. Let's go back to David Hedison, who will tell us about working with actress Priscilla Barnes.
We went to the airport together. We did our scenes together. She's bubbly and alive and absolutely fantastic and beautiful. I was so happy that she played my wife. It was really great.
For Benicio del Toro, who went on to appear in the hit The Usual Suspects, as well as Excess Baggage and Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, License to Kill was only his second film. His first was Big Top Pee Wee, in which he played Duke, the dog-faced boy. Only 22 at the time of License to Kill, he became the screen's youngest Bond villain. David Hedison remembers Del Toro.
Benicio, well, he was a kid when he did that. But you could see the beginnings of something wonderful. He has a wonderful talent. I just congratulated him. I said, continued success. I've been watching your work, Benicio, and it is terrific. He's turned out to be a wonderful actor.
Hedison's most memorable scene came acting opposite Robert Davi.
Oh, Robert Davi, the guy that threw me to the sharks. Robert is a lovely man, and we got on very, very well. This was, you know, I guess, the first time he played a heavy, and he was super. And we had great fun and lots of laughs. We really had a good time, that cast. I mean, that's one great thing about the Bond films. Everyone gets on so well together. It's like one great, big, happy family.
Robert Davi, like many film actors, worked with screenwriters to give his character more of a focus. In this scene, Davi suggested a key piece of dialogue, which he used as a touchstone for the character of Sanchez for the rest of the film.
Loyalty is more important to me than money.
And that line alone set up the whole spine, which wasn't there initially. It's kind of set up the whole spine for Sanchez to have a different kind of commitment. So you saw when he was betrayed by Bond, when, you know, he gave Bond his loyalty, and Bond betrays that loyalty. And it's very interesting, because if you analyze all the acts of violence, even from the opening whipping of Talitha, beautiful Talisa Soto, who plays Lupi, Sanchez's girlfriend, every act of violence that Sanchez commits is in reaction to what's been stepped on him. For instance, if it was a chess match, he was attacked first before he retaliated. You know, he was, like I always said, he was the Donald Trump of, you know, he would be Donald Trump if he was in legitimate business.
Back to David Hedison on the filming of Leiter's death.
My wife was there, and she saw the first run-through of it, and she couldn't stand it. She had to leave, you know, and it was, I had decided to play it very realistically as I could, as if I were going down into the shark pit. Maybe I could have played it differently, more heroically, so it wouldn't have been as horrible to watch. And there was a lot of footage on that scene, and a lot of it was cut, because it was much too violent.
Robert Davi had a different perspective on the violence in the scene.
I mean, there was a shark. You know, I mean, we're looking down in a pit, basically, you know, an empty pit half the time, and lowering them down, and you know how they do all their stunt stuff, and that was not a, I guess, more the compression chamber thing had more an effect on me than the shark thing. You know, I don't see what the fuss was about the shark thing. We had a movie called Jaws that was, you know, tremendously frightening in that aspect, you know. You know, feed the Christian to the lions. I mean, this was a shark, you know.
One of the reasons producers felt they could include a scene with this much graphic violence was the acting style of Timothy Dalton. Kerry Lowell recalls Timothy Dalton's approach to playing the darker side of James Bond.
I was trying to rack my brain to think of when I first met Timothy, and I don't remember. I think it was at a press junket in Los Angeles. We did a press conference where everybody came, and we had to stand up in front of the press and announce that we were the new Bond people, and that this is what the movie was going to be about. And I remember Timothy then, and he was very gentlemanly, very reserved, and very serious. And he remained that way through most of the filming, and not in a negative way, but just very professional. And he really, really put a lot of thought and care into how he played the part. And that inspired me to do the same. And I think when you work with an actor who's better than you, you try to rise to their level. And Timothy definitely motivated me to do that. He did laugh and did relax many times. I don't want to mean like he was like a stone face, because he was a really sweetheart. And he was just a... I'm really glad that it was Timothy that was the Bond that I was working with, because I think I learned a lot from him, just in terms of how to approach the part, what, you know, how to dissect it and what to look for, and how to present yourself.
Lowell was not the only actor impressed with Dalton's dedication to his craft. Benicio del Toro recalls how he felt Dalton's Bond was unique.
Timothy Dalton, he brought in this take on James Bond that was different from Roger Moore or Sean Connery, which was like more like a, especially in License to Kill, more of a method kind of like take on James Bond, more like coming from feelings, you know, coming from, you know, not so aloof. And he brought this element, and which, you know, it's a different interpretation of James Bond, you know.
This scene is straight from Ian Fleming's novel Live and Let Die, including the wording on the note found on Leiter's body. For director John Glenn, it was Dalton who made moments like this possible in a Bond film. It would have been the wrong tone for Roger Moore, or even Sean Connery. John Glenn remembers what he felt Dalton brought to the role.
This type of character suited Timothy Dalton more. He was a I mean, he's a Shakespearean actor. He can act very well in any situation. So we try to give him scenes where, you know, his acting ability would be used to the full. Certain things we did with Timothy Dalton we would never have done with Roger Moore, for instance. Roger played a more, as good as he was in those things, he played a lighter character. In License to Kill, we see it's a darker subject, and somehow we portray Bond as a slightly deeper, darker person in a lot of ways. I think he grabbed the essence of that, of the Fleming character. I remember we had long conversations about it. He tried to get back to the essential James Bond, if you like. A large part of the character depends on the actor who plays it, obviously, the way he feels comfortable.
Dalton carefully researched the Fleming novels in preparing to play Bond. He was particularly fascinated by Bond's uncertainties and self-doubts in the original stories. He tried to bring out these elements and make his own mark on the character, as Carrie Lowell remembers.
He definitely wanted to make his Bond a different person, a different character than had preceded him. I mean, it's hard to fill Sean Connery's shoes. And I don't think that Timothy was necessarily trying to do that. I think he was trying to change it and make it his own. And I think he did that by making it more gritty and realistic and making Bond really feel emotions and be sad or be angry or depressed. Or he was a moody Bond on camera. And actually following Roger Moore, it was a big difference because he was much more sort of untouchable, always in the white suit, sort of coming through these disasters unscathed, and Timothy was the exact opposite. I mean, at the end when there's a tanker truck exploding, he's got gashes and blood and he's all messed up, and he's like, and he still has the, you know, the final moment, and it's wonderful.
We're closed. Ain't nobody here.
Look, I've come all the way from London to see you. Universal Exports, we've been retained by the Regent's Park Zoo to arrange shipment of a Carcharodon carcharias.
A what?
Great white shark.
It's all right, Bill, let him in. Unfortunately, we sold all...
Anthony Zerbe was a veteran actor of TV westerns of the 1950s and 60s. He also appeared with Sean Connery in 1970's The Molly Maguires and acted in such memorable films as The Life and Times of Judge Roy Bean, Papillon, and The Parallax View. He had a role in the 1983 TV movie Return of the Man from U.N.C.L.E., which also featured former 007 George Lazenby. Director John Glenn remembers working with Zerbe.
Yeah, Anthony Zerbe is another very, very extraordinary actor. Very menacing in a quirky sort of way. Ideal for a Bond movie, really. I mean, if you remember rightly, he got his comeuppance in the by Robert Darby in the pressurization tank, or depressurization tank, I should say, except that Darby switches it round, and resulting in Anthony Zerbe being blown up.
Carrie Lowell also has fond memories of working with Anthony Zerbe.
He was such a sweetie. He just always sort of was really supportive, just, you know, telling me that I was doing a great job. And I remember met the premiere in London, and it was such an event. And, you know, you go to one of those things, you're going to meet the Prince and Princess of Wales, and what am I going to wear? And I had this dress, and I wasn't sure. And he just said, "You look amazing, and you are what we have to offer. Look at you. You're this beautiful American girl. You're what we have to offer to the British." And it was just so sweet.
James.
The music for License to Kill was provided by Michael Kamen, a composer whose first film score was for the Sean Connery movie The Next Man in 1976. director John Glynn remembers working with Michael Kamen.
The music plays such an important part in a James Bond film. On License to Kill, we after looking at a lot of other composers' work, John Barry couldn't do the film. We used Michael Kamen in the end. That was the choice we made. And I think we probably made the choice because we felt that he could give us the closest thing we could get to John Barry. Michael's a very clever guy. He can adapt music, and he works in a quite different way, a very modern way. He's got a studio in London, and it wasn't a problem working here. And I was able to go up to his house and have meetings with him about, and he would run me ideas because he put stuff down roughly because he's got his own electronic theme, give you a rough idea of what you're going to hear and so forth. So it worked very well. Very talented guy. He'd been doing the Lethal Weapon series. I think that's what drew our attention to him in the first place. But he did a very good score. And I think he incorporated a lot of the John Barry feel about the score, so that you weren't really aware, possibly, that we got a different composer.
Over by the trap door, old buddy.
Is this where you put your old buddy, Felix?
Not me. Chalk that one up to Sanchez and Crest.
$2 million, that's...
When a strike by the Writers Guild forced Richard Maybaum to pull out of the project, producer Michael Wilson completed the screenplay on his own. Benicio del Toro remembers Wilson.
Michael Wilson was, very much hands-on on the script. He's one of the writers, and so he was always on the set, willing to listen in some ways and make some comments and scenes. What a terrible waste. Soft-spoken, And he's a lawyer, too, and my dad is a lawyer, so I think my dad came to visit me on the set, so that immediately he looked at me a little bit different after that than just a young punk, very young.
David Hedison also recalls Michael Wilson.
I like Michael too, and my wife loved Michael. She liked that whole family, and we got on very well. He's a very smart fellow, very intelligent. He was great to talk to. He had lovely stories to tell.
Carrie Lowell remembers being entertained at Michael Wilson's house in Mexico City and learning of his other passions besides James Bond.
Michael used to throw great parties at his house in San Angel, which is where a lot of us stayed in Mexico City. And he invited everybody into his home and served us, took care of us, fed us. Was very sweet in that way. But what I most remember about Michael is that he had the most amazing photography collection. And when I was in Los Angeles, he invited me over to his house for lunch with a friend of mine and his family. And they had invited a man called Weston Neff, who was the head of the Getty photography collection. He was a curator, and he proceeded to lay out the most extraordinary photographs, early 18th century photographs, some of the first ever taken, and so beautiful.
License to Kill was John Glenn's fifth Bond film as director and the last Bond film of the 1980s. During that decade, each film appeared like clockwork every 2 years. By the time of License to Kill, there was a development process in place, which was unique to the Bond films. The development for License to Kill proved to be particularly hectic, and the producers started with the notion of setting a Bond story in China, and then ultimately faced moving the entire production to Mexico. John Glenn remembers.
We always try and get that element of being a bit of a rebel into his character. And when he's told in no uncertain terms by M that he has to discontinue the case because he's getting emotionally and involved in the case, he decides that he's going to leave. He leaps off the balcony, and there's even gunmen there who prepare to shoot him for disobeying orders. So it was important that he pursued this case through for personal reasons. He had to go after Robert Darby, this drug lord, and he was determined to do it, even if it cost him his job. He was going to do it, and that's kind of a tradition in Bond films, I think. With, you know, he's got a history, and if you look back through all the movies, of doing his own thing and going his own way, in spite of direct orders, he will break orders if necessary.
Don't kill too many people. God help you, Commander.
Something in Sector C.
Sanchez's tormented girlfriend, Lupe Lamora, was played by former model Talisa Soto. Prior to License to Kill, she acted in 1998's Spike of Bensonhurst. She went on to play Maria in 1992's The Mambo Kings and has appeared in numerous other films. Robert Davi remembers Soto.
Talisa Soto, beautiful woman, and she was just a joy. She was... We had a lot of fun times watching television. You know, you had 5 months on a film like that. And she was just great sense of humor, great dancer. We went out dancing a lot, and you know, that was very pleasurable. Yeah, she's great.
You better watch yourself, girlie. I've known him a long time. I've seen a lot of girls like you come and go.
You're drunk. Get out. And stop peeking through my windows.
Hey, come on. What are you so stuck up for? You fix that phony beauty contest.
You won.
Hey.
Mr. Chris.
Yeah, what?
The Sentinel's picking up something large on the monitor, sir. I think you'd better take a look.
I don't believe this. What the hell is it now?
It's just a manta ray. Get the probe back in. We'll start loading now.
Yes, sir.
License to Kill, like every Eon-produced Bond film before, bears the mark of one of the industry's great producers, Albert R. Broccoli. Actor Robert Davi remembers the man everyone knew simply as Cubby.
Cubby Broccoli was a thrill to have met him and to know him. He extended friendship and you know, you're often doing other films, and I'd been to his house and his wife, Dana. Cubby, to me, was one of the... He was a giant. He was like one of the last of the old moguls, you know? I mean, that old touch with Hollywood. And he had done tremendous stories that he had and tremendous history of film. I mean, he's known for the Bond films, but he had done, you know, a ton of movies in London with Alan Ladd and different kinds of, you know, Men Who Do Manly Thing kind of movies. And he was just... a real supporter of mine. He had a sensibility of making a film that would last. He and Dana always talked about, they like to put on the Bond films 10 years from now and not have it feel dated. And they were very careful, and, you know, maybe sometimes they missed with that in something, but for the most part, if you look at the Bond films, you don't get a feeling of an ancient, there's still a contemporary in the dress and something. There's a classic element to all those films.
Cubby Broccoli grew up in Long Island and worked on his uncle's farm. It is true that his family imported the first broccoli seeds to the United States and that Cubby's forebears developed the vegetable. In 1934, Cubby came to Hollywood. With his partner Irving Allen, he went on to be one of the most successful independent producers of the 1950s before launching the Bonds with Harry Saltzman. For nearly 40 years, Cubby Broccoli was a major force in the film industry. Carrie Lowell has her own memories of working with Cubby.
I just have this memory of Cubby as just being this gentlemanly sort of patriarchal figure. He was for everybody, I think, because he'd been the father of all the Bond films for so many years. He's such a gentleman, and even in his office you get this feeling of history, because there's all these photos and memorabilia about his years of being a Bond producer. He's just very relaxed and obviously knew exactly what he wanted.
Cubby Broccoli was a legend long before License to Kill began shooting. Cubby entered the film industry as a lowly stage assistant at 20th Century Fox and quickly moved up to assistant director before later becoming an agent and a producer. Actor Benicio del Toro was in awe of Cubby Broccoli.
He had that quality that, you know, few men have. You know, he walks into a room and it's like, you know he's in that room. He had that presence. And I remember sitting down with him and among other people, you know, I was the youngest guy sitting there, you know, just sat there and listened and talked a little bit about his past. And I also remember my audition, you know, when I went to meet him, you know, when I went and met him, just asked a few questions, you know, like, how tall are you? How much you weigh? And I like him. He was, he was a force of nature, you know. He's one of the most successful producers in Hollywood ever, or the most. He just knew what he wanted. Strong, you know. My memory is like he would walk into that room or any room, or even if it was outdoors, and you just saw him. You know, he was a star. He was a star. He was definitely the star. Everybody, even James Bond, you see him buckle down, you know. Timothy Dalton, you know, Cubby would walk into the room. He was the star, yeah.
Cubby Broccoli passed away on June 27, 1996, at the age of 87. In 1998, his autobiography, When the Snow Melts, was published in England. In the book, Cubby recounts his adventurous life, from watching Charles Lindbergh fly over Long Island on his transatlantic flight to becoming friends with aviation pioneer Howard Hughes. While Cubby did not create James Bond, he certainly has been the one person most responsible for shepherding 007 through the twists and turns of popular culture and changing public tastes. From 1962 on through the development of GoldenEye, Pierce Brosnan's first Bond film. For all of this, Cubby was a rather soft-spoken man, often making self-effacing jokes. He did not bask in his success, but gained his greatest joys from entertaining. He once said to a reporter that he considered it bad taste to brag about box office grosses when people were starving in the world. Cubby Broccoli received one of the highest honors in the film industry on March 29, 1982, when the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences awarded Cubby the Irving Thalberg Memorial Award in front of a television audience of almost 1 billion viewers. Roger Moore presented the bust of Thalberg to Cubby. Cubby immediately thanked his former partners, Irving Allen and Harry Saltzman, for their part in his success. He then thanked Arthur Krim, the man at United Artists, who had made the decision to finance Dr. No, the first James Bond film. Cubby never lost touch with his roots on Long Island. His philanthropic work helped build a community center for the Variety Boys and Girls Club of Queens, New York. Cubby's generosity was not limited to charities. He often came to the aid of those who had worked on his films and later fell on hard times. He was known as one of the best friends one could have in the film industry. Cubby not only lived to see the James Bond films become the most successful and longest-running film series ever, he had the chance to see his stepson, Michael Wilson, and his daughter, Barbara Broccoli, successfully bring the series into the 1990s.
Ring Sentinel up!
With License to Kill, I mean, there are many major action sequences within the movie. When you meet these stuntmen and you've known them for years, and they come up with some good ideas sometimes, and it all goes into the computer, you know, in your computer, your personal computer, and you remember them when you come to actually start to develop an action sequence.
This scene, developed by Sparky Green and his wife, has proven to be a favorite among fans of the movie. 007 finds himself trapped with no apparent escape. The filmmakers have even taken away his oxygen. Back to John Glenn.
With the wave crash sequence where Bond is forced to leap overboard and has to hide away from the guns that are waiting on the surf when he surfaces, that's a very good sequence, I thought. Again, a very unique scene where Bond grabs the line and gets yanked out of the sea and finishes up skiing on his bare feet behind the seaplane. Unique Bond action scene. Don't tell me how that came about. It was like a whole series of working with all these guys who do these fantastic stunts and ski with their bare feet. That was the thought behind it, was getting Bond to ski on with his bare feet. And then we developed this idea of how he gets what pulls him along. We decided it'd be the seaplane, so that's how it works out. Then we get these crazy guys who say they can do these things, you know. And BJ Worth, he's our aerial stuntman, and he comes along and he says, oh yeah, I think we can do that. And then we construct handholds for him on the aeroplane, and we have him clinging onto the outside of an aeroplane. We've done this stuff for so many years, I suppose we get blasé about it, but those boys have done some wonderful stuff for us over the years. It all had to be tied in with the seaplane taking off with the loot, with the drug money. And this is all carefully worked out on the storyboard. We then get the artist to actually develop the drawings so that people can actually, you know, see what is required. Then a whole crowd of us will sit around a table and we'll break down. Each element is in that storyboard. There's a picture for each element, and we will then work out how we're going to achieve that particular section. And we're only talking about a three-second piece sometimes. We then split the stuff up to first unit, second unit, airborne sequence, underwater sequence. So we have like four different crews shooting each segment. Not each segment, but some segments we designate to the underwater sequence. So we use Raymond Bravo and his crew. May not even be shot there, might be shot in the Bahamas. You know, could be shot miles from where we are. The aerial sequence, they come in for the stuff above surface where the water skier is on the back of the aeroplane. Maybe the general stunt arranger will take care of it up until the point the plane takes off. That point the aerial people come in. The aeroplane has to be selected. We have to fix up handholds on the outside of the aeroplane so James Bond can scramble around, find his way into the aircraft. In the script it might be half a page or a quarter of a page will describe a sequence that will take probably 6 weeks to shoot, you know, with various units all over the world. It's a quarter of a page, and it has to be broken down into each tiny section of the film. And I think that's what we're masters at. We just take one shot at a time and work out how we achieve that. And then, like magic, at the end of the day, it all cuts together and it looks like it was all shot at that moment in time.
To play the part of Pam Bouvier, producers chose former model Carrie Lowell, whose previous films included Club Paradise and Me and Him, an offbeat comedy starring Griffin Dunn, which became a huge hit in Germany. Lowell and Dunn were soon husband and wife. Since License to Kill, she has acted in Sleepless in Seattle, Love Affair, Leaving Las Vegas, and Fierce Creatures.
Carrie Lowell was one of probably dozens of actresses that came in to the office, you know, for the part. And it's also a consensus in a way. I mean, Cubby and Michael and Barbara and myself sort of have to agree, basically, on who we think. And, you know, it's like all those things, a little bit committee. Necessarily so with the Bond movies, it's just the concept. We've always been famous for having beautiful leading ladies, setting new trends sometimes.
The villain's henchman in a Bond film is often outfitted with an elaborate means of killing 007. Benicio del Toro's character, Dario, is outfitted with a deadly knife, which flips out into his hand.
We had that knife that came out kind of like popped out into the hand, which was kind of like hard because you had to hold on. The arm had to be kind of stiff a little bit. So if you see the film, you know when I'm going to pull out the knife because one arm is like a wooden arm. I did a little bit of training of how to do the knife, and you know I practiced with that thing, but it was very temperamental. You know, it just every now and then I would move the arm, pew, comes flying out the knife.
He's just mean. Aside from his deadly weapon, Benicio del Toro had another accoutrement in the film, although it makes less of an impact than his knife. He wore a gold tooth, which he sometimes misses.
Do your friends want something?
Let me get it.
The gold tooth. It was a real gold tooth, you know. I think that was John Glenn's idea, you know, to give this character some gold, you know, something like kind of like creepy. One thing I regret is the fact that I didn't keep the tooth, because I could have used it in another film or something like that. Yeah, I lost the tooth, but I think he added something like a little touch to the character.
Carrie Lowell recalls filming the fight at the Barrelhead Bar.
The stuff in the bar, there was a lot of stuff in the Barrelhead Bar where I had to break bottles and flip people, and in fact I had a stunt double who was this really great girl and really strong, and she just took this huge guy and flipped him over her head, and I was really happy to have a stunt double at that moment because I knew there was no way I was going to pull that one off and make it look good. But he was a very experienced stunt coordinator and had done this many times, and I don't think, as I recall, there were any mishaps. Everything kind of went like clockwork.
Acting in these scenes and the following sequence on the boat, Carrie Lowell felt like she had stepped back into old-fashioned movie making.
That was one of the first scenes we also shot. I think that came after the Felix's study. And that was when I had to handle a gun. I had a gun with me under the table, a big rifle in my lap, and I was supposed to shoot a hole through the table, and then we get up and we start fighting. And I look at that scene now, and I wish I had more experience, that I had been a better actress, because I think that it could have been so much better. But it served its purpose. It kind of introduced Bond and I to one another and gave me this tough girl image who then breaks out of the bar and falls onto the back of this boat, and we go racing off, and then suddenly we're kissing in the moonlight, which is an amazing story too, because all of that scene was shot on a stage. We're on a boat, a piece of a boat that's being kind of rocked by people on the sides, and in the back is this kind of sparkly starlit backdrop with the light on it, and then water, and they keep kind of throwing a little bit of water on us, a little bit of wind, and it was completely like old style movie making. It wasn't on location, obviously. It was in this stage, and I felt like I was part of history at that moment, because I really felt like I had entered the old school of filmmaking, and that these people knew their stuff, and that this is how they made movies, realism was something else to them. Realism is what makes the scene shine and be magical. It's not about realism like we're all getting seasick out in the water because we've been trying to get this shot and it's nighttime and why the thing can't get the light right. Everything was very controlled and everything was very sedate as a result, because there were no mistakes, and it played. I mean, it worked. It was an extraordinary way to make the scene work.
How many men have you...
During the long shoot, Carrie Lowell developed a close friendship with Timothy Dalton, as well as a strong professional respect.
I mean, it was a five-month shoot, practically. We'd eaten out more times than I can count. We'd dance together. We'd had laughs together. We'd probably had arguments together. And absolutely, we bonded a friendship, and I haven't really kept in touch with him since. But we did go to the premiere in London together and had a wonderful time. He's a great guy.
You get the plane.
Dalton's energy and earnestness with the character of James Bond helped change the intensity of many scenes with his co-stars. Carrie Lowell recalls the sense of gravity that Dalton brought to the role of James Bond and how that affected her performance.
You're asked.
Well, why don't you ask?
And so when he kisses you, you feel like, huh, he's actually kissing me. It's not like he's just got to kiss the girl, you know? So I think when you see it on the film, it's like, oh, maybe there is more there than just like this guy's tossing off these chicks the right and left. And everything got a little bit more intense because Timothy is an intense person and puts weight into what he plays, and I think it comes across in the film.
Dalton was not the only actor who had an effect on his co-stars and crew. Director John Glenn remembers Carrie Lowell's bewitching effect on others while she was on the set.
I think Carrie Lowell was probably... I think every member... every male member of the crew was in love with this girl. I mean, she is delightful. Not only is she beautiful and got a wonderful figure, but she's also such a lovely girl. And I mean, Alec Mills' son was the clapper boy on the set, and he could hardly get the clapper board up, and you know, and show, he was so, like, when she was on the set, he was so taken with her, you know. She was so gorgeous.
Cue brunch, please.
Robert Davi remembers another side of Carrie Lowell.
Carrie, very spiritual, very sweet girl. Again, an intelligent woman. I remember mostly her spiritual essence.
David Hedison had only one major scene with Carrie Lowell, but he enjoyed working with her on the film.
Carrie Lowell is a beautiful lady. I just adore her. She reminds me of my oldest daughter. They have the same sort of look.
Sign the registration cards? No, my executive secretary.
Lowell remembers her preparation for the role.
I can't say that I went out with CIA agents and went on special missions. It wasn't really like that at all. I watched a lot of old Bond films, and I got an idea sort of it's very, I don't want to say cartoonish, but in a deprecating way, but it is cartoonish because the people aren't really, it's certainly not realistic. And in fact, that's what Timothy Dalton was trying to do when he played Bond, was make it realistic and gritty, and Bond bleeds and Bond feels pain and gets dirty, and that's, it's very evident in License to Kill. But I basically just tried to just relax because it was such a, it seemed like such a huge shoes to fill, to come in and be a Bond girl after so many people had come before me. And it seems, and it still to this day seems like I've entered this pantheon of women.
When she was first approached for the role, Carrie Lowell was not sure if she fit the classic image of a Bond girl.
My thoughts were Ursula Andress, big buxom blonde, walking out of the sea in that white bikini. And I knew I wasn't. I mean, I had short hair, which was, you know, in the beginning of the film, they put me in a wig because I didn't know what to do. And then they let me cut my hair, as my character cut my hair as part of the storyline. But I just didn't see myself as that glamorous sort of babe. And I think it's the fact that I even went to the audition in jeans and a leather jacket sort of depicts my state of mind. It wasn't, like a babe.
When the production moved to Mexico for the scenes in the film's second half, one of the locations was the Mexico City Post Office. Director John Glenn recalls.
Some wonderful locations there. The post office, for instance, is just unbelievable. All wrought iron. We use that for the bank. Robert Darby's bank, personal bank. That was fun. We just closed it down on a Sunday and shot on a Sunday there when there weren't any customers around. It was wonderful.
And of course there will be additional monthly deposits in the same amount.
Of course. Be assured we at Banco de Estos are experienced in handling accounts of this nature.
Let me pass.
No, no, señorita. No puede pasar. Sin permiso. Tenemos un cliente aquí.
Señor Montalongo.
Yes?
I'm Miss Kennedy.
Oh?
Mr. Bond's executive secretary.
I'd also appreciate it if you could establish a line of credit for me at the casino. Shall we say $2 million?
No problem. You have excellent collateral. And our chairman also owns the casino.
Oh, a very convenient arrangement.
We have always thought so, señorita.
Among Robert Davi's co-stars in Mexico was one non-speaking actor, an iguana. John Glenn recalls...
Again, this appealed to Darby. He loved to play his villain with humor, and he was a very laid-back villain, and he had this iguana on his shoulder with a diamond necklace, which was a real diamond necklace, believe me. And he would say, impromptu, during the scene, he said, he turned around and the animal was getting quite friendly with him, and he said, "Yo, give us a kiss," you know. He did it. You know, on the camera without any prompting, you know, just improvised it. And that's wonderful when an actor can do that. You know, you can just take advantage, because you never know what you're going to get with an animal, so you have to be ready for anything.
Robert Davi remembers being sometimes upstaged by his reptilian co-star.
I remember I had the iguana. We called it Iguanita. And we're doing a scene, and... the iguana's on my shoulder, and I got it for some reason. It liked me. It didn't like Talisa Soto, the iguana. It scratched her. Maybe it was a cologne or perfume, but it took a liking to me, this iguana. And in one of the scenes, some of it made it and some of it didn't, but he would put perch his head over to here, and I would whisper to him. I would say little secrets to the iguana. And John thought that was great. And I remember on one specific shot, he said to the iguana, he gave it some directions, and he said, "That's fantastic. It was great." And he comes over and he takes the iguana. "You're such a good little actor. You're so terrific, blah, 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 blah." I said, "John, what about me?" You know, he ignored me. And he was like, "Let's give a close-up of the iguana." And he set this whole thing up as a send-off on me. I'm going to pull in tight on the iguana, give him that key light. Let's get his eyes. Do we have his eyes? And he's really concentrating and focusing. I'm just like standing there. Wondering, so that was, so we had fun.
Let me have half a million.
Si, señor.
Listen to this. Our wonderful Manhattan Chapel has just made a special $500 pledge.
500 kilos. I
thank you. A 500.
I knew they'd go for it.
This guy cracks me up.
What a night.
Yes, he's right here.
We've got senior citizens calling in, sending them.
Yeah. I got a British sucker who dropped $250,000.
And he wants to play No Limit.
Which one?
Table 2. We don't want you to give. Plays like a real jerk off.
That's the guy that flew in the private plane today. Opened the account at the bank. $5 million in cash. Goes to the restoration
of this magnificent ceremony. Let him play.
Double down.
Split.
The shoot in Mexico was a different experience for the Bond crew, which had only filmed a short second unit scene in Mexico for Moonraker in 1979. For the actors, Mexico was a working holiday in another culture. Some stayed at hotels, while others rented houses near the studios. All enjoyed the ambiance and Latin flavor of Mexico City and the locations. Carrie Lowell was originally disappointed when she heard the film would be based in Mexico, but she quickly discovered that there were benefits to shooting south of the border.
I grew up in Colorado, and Mexico was a place that I had visited frequently before then. So when I heard I got the Bond film, I thought Morocco, China, you know, India. Beautiful exotic places, fabulous exotic places. But they said, well, we'll be shooting in Mexico City for the duration of the film, basically. Which was okay, because I love Mexico, and the people are incredibly kind and warm. And I did speak a little bit of Spanish, so I wasn't completely out of my element. And also, you know, it's really close to Los Angeles. It's right there. So there wasn't, when you did have time off, you could go home. But I loved it. By the end of my stay there, I was drinking the water out of the tap, which is I had become a señorita. I was, the lunches were amazing because I'm a vegetarian, and it was always rice and beans and tortillas and guacamole and salsa and whatever you wanted like that. And it was really healthy, and the people were just so generous. They have a very warm-hearted spirit in Mexico, and I just felt really comfortable there. They had beautiful homes in the area where we were staying, this place called San Angel, and wonderful markets. And it was, I shared a house with Tina Broccoli. We had a great time. We threw big parties in our house, and everybody came over, and we had a great time.
For director John Glenn, Mexico brings back fond memories.
We based the whole film in Mexico City with locations in Key West, Florida, and a lot of underwater material. And, you know, the whole thing was centered more from Mexico. All the other films we'd always done at Pinewood Studios, and you know, we would choose locations without any thought about where we were. But I think in this instance, you know, we were in Mexico, and there's some fantastic locations around there, and we tried to use them. We found, for instance, the ancient sites in Mexico, like the pyramids and so forth, were pretty dull places to film, actually, and there were so many restrictions by the tourist authorities, because they get thousands of people through there every day, and you know, you can't really work, can't make a big action sequence if you've got those restrictions. All you can basically do is build it yourself, which is something we didn't fancy doing.
Robert Davi, a practical joker, enjoyed shooting in Mexico City.
Mexico was great. One story, I had a driver there 5 months, Jose Hernandez. One time I remember driving through the streets of Churubusco and Mexico City, and I had this bullhorn and stuff, and I was, every other week there was another manifestation that was going on there, some marching, some new guy for president, so I put him up for president, and I would go around, Jose Hernandez para presidente de Mexico, and we'd drive through and this and that, but that was fun. The crew was great, they were artisans, great work, you know, they, hard work, albeit they did it in their time, but it was great working in Mexico, and It was a lot of fun, you know. We're in Polanco. We stayed at the Hotel Nico, actually. I got us all into the Hotel Nico in Polanco. They were staying at another hotel, the Crown Plaza or something in Mexico City. And I went searching for hotels. And this Hotel Nico was the newest hotel being built up. And I went there and I said, hey, I'm doing this Bond film. What kind of deal can I get on the room? Because we were paid, you know, I got to pay for my own hotel room in terms of, you know, you make so much per diem. That was put in so they didn't have to do it. And I made a great deal for this great suite, you know, at the hotel with a piano and all of this stuff, you know, that Sanchez would have had. And then wound up, most of the crew came there. And so it was good.
Well, one has to show a special talent that people here don't have.
Well, that shouldn't be too difficult.
Senor Bond, you got big cojones. You come here, to my place, without references, carrying a piece, throwing around a lot of money. But you should know something. Nobody saw you come in, so nobody has to see you go out.
Senor Sanchez, I could be very useful to a man in your position. And I understand you have a reputation for awarding loyalty very well.
I'll keep this for a few days. We'll talk again. And you won't need a gun in Ismis.
Robert Davi's practical jokes were not restricted to his off-set activities. He also liked to lighten the atmosphere on the set when he could, and even plied his mischief during dailies. By the time the shoot was ready to wrap, the crew was pulling many pranks on Davi, who enjoyed the turnabout. John Glenn remembers how Davi was able to lift the cast and crew's spirits during the shoot.
I remember he came on one scene we were doing. He came with the false nose and the cigar, and he, you know, when I expected to see Robert come round as the villain around the corridor, what appeared was one of the Marx brothers. You know, he was doing his stuff, you know, and then he sang a very popular song called Don't Worry. He recorded that, and when we went to Rushes, we were having a particularly hard time, and just before the Rushes came up, this song came up on the speakers in the cinema, you know, Don't Worry.
One of the more fashionable props in the film was actually found by the producers at, of all places, an audition. Sometimes actresses bring more to the role than just their performances, as Robert Davi explains.
The idea for that dress that she has, where she hides her gun, where Carrie Lowe hides her gun, came from a dress that Talisa Soto wore to her audition when she tested. There was a dress that she had on that she played one long evening scene in, and then just ripped this off and it became a short little dress. So they got that idea from the dress that Talisa wore to her testing.
Really, 007.
A veteran of 14 previous James Bond adventures, beginning with From Russia with Love, Desmond Llewellyn receives more screen time in License to Kill than in any other 007 film.
Oh, I loved License to Kill because I had a large part in it, and it was great fun, and it was great fun acting with Timothy Dalton and Carrie Lowell. I mean, she was marvellous to work with, so was Timothy. And, I mean, it was real fun. I mean, I'd never really been on location much before doing things. And I loved every moment of it.
Born in Wales in 1914, Llewellyn made his first film appearance in the 1930s with movies such as 1939's Ask a Policeman. In the 1950s, his film roles included They Were Not Divided, an acclaimed World War II drama directed by Terence Young, and A Night to Remember, about the sinking of the Titanic. After playing a senator in the Elizabeth Taylor film Cleopatra, Llewellyn took on the role of Q in the James Bond films. He also played Coggan in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, a parody of his Q persona in the Bond films. Llewellyn shares his view of what makes the Bond films work.
You must keep fantasy with Bond.
And not only fantasy, but pure relaxation, enjoyment. I mean, what you see on the screen is something that you don't have in this world today. You can just sit back and enjoy it. I went to a memorial service of a friend in London, in a big church there, and the parson was talking to me afterwards. And he said, you know, when I've had a really hard day and I'm feeling absolutely whacked, he said, I get a drink and I sit down and I put on a Bond film for relaxation.
In each of his Bond film appearances, Desmond Llewellyn has worn a different tie, creating a history through his neckwear.
Q, he's a Welsh guardsman who was in the Guards Armour Division. The Guards tie, and in the last one, I wore the Guards Armour Division. He went to Radley because he wears a Radley tie. He plays cricket because he's also rows, which is very difficult. He was at Trinity because he's wore a Trinity tie. He's a member of the MCC, which is not the Marylebone Cricket Club, but the Malpas Cricket Club. He also was a keen supporter and played rugby for Newport, all in Gwent. What other ties have I worn? I wear a different tie every time, you see, and they all, I have got the sort of the history of Q worked out.
In this business, there's a lot of cash. And with a lot of people with their hands out.
In a word, bribery.
Exactly. He took the words right out of my pocket. So you pay. Everyone and his brother is on the payroll. So you buy a mayor, chief of police, general. President. One day you wake up, you own the whole goddamn country. Then you take what you want. Bank, gambling casino, airline concession. Why? Simply. It's easier for the politicians to take silver than lead. We have an invisible empire from Chile to Alaska. What I want to do, amigos,
one of the most popular characters in License to Kill is Truman Lodge, played by Anthony Stark. Carrie Lowell remembers her young co-star.
He was somebody that was my age, sort of, and kind of going in and was just as nervous as I was, and a really nice guy, and played it with, you know, great professionalism. He had to do all the talking. He was sort of Sanchez's little right arm that did all the deal-making. United
States. Carrie Lowell vividly remembers the premiere of License to Kill at London's Leicester Square Odeon Theatre on June 13th, 1989.
They put me at a beautiful hotel. I had this amazing driver with a Daimler, beautiful car, and I was told I was able to go to Tiffany's and choose out the jewelry that I wanted to wear to the premiere. I borrowed these beautiful sapphire and diamond earrings and a bracelet, and I had on this great Armani dress. And when I arrived with Timothy, there were so many people. I had no idea the sort of height of Bond mania. And we actually got out of our car and walked along the way, because there was so much traffic we couldn't get in, and people people. And we walked inside, and then I just remember it was like a lot of press and people wanting to talk, and then we all had to line up because Prince Charles and Diana were coming. And it was a kind of fairy tale thing. Ellie prepares you for that, and Tim and I were at the very end of the line, so we saw everybody else, you know, say hello and watch them all, and they came to us, and Charles came first, and he was very proper and stately. So good to meet you and everything, and then Diana came, and she was completely different and so warm and really breathtaking. You don't really get how beautiful she was from her photograph. She had a great thing about her, and she just, you know, looked. Said, God, it's hot in here. Isn't it hot in here? She was just so normal and sweet and really kind of made me feel completely at ease. And so then we went in and watched the film, and I was sitting next to Charles, and Timothy was sitting next to Diana. And Charles was hilarious because every time something would happen on the screen, he'd be like, oh, ah, look. Every stunt, every sort of tough thing was like, oh, ah. Is that a stunt? Was that a stunt? I said, yeah. Those sharks aren't real. That's not. I'm sort of like talking him through the film. It was really funny. And an experience I'll never forget. I mean, it was like being in the royal box and there was banners hanging down. I think they even had people playing little horns before we sat down.
Actor Robert Davi shares his memories of the royal premiere, as well as the guest of honor, Princess Diana.
And then the premiere in London. I mean, I get to meet Prince Charles and Princess Diana. It's a funny story on the receiving line. Embarrassing, but, you know, here I am. I'm in London. We're on the receiving line. Timothy Dalton, myself, Delisa, Carrie, Cubby Broccoli, and, you know, Barbara. And Prince Charles is coming down the line, and they're meeting the people that are before you. And you really, when you finally meet the prince and princess, you know in your head, well, I can't really stare them up and down and check them out and this and that and the other thing. And this whole idea of the princess and Princess Diana. So as she was like four people away from me, you know, and Prince Charles was very charming and, I mean, he was very easy conversationalist. But as the princess was coming down, I remember like three people away from me kind of like doing one of these. Trying to, you know, just scan her through this MRI on her, you know what I mean, on the royalty, I don't know. Probably a bit lecherous on my part, I don't know, but I mean, I'm looking at her like that, and then she's coming, because you can't do that when you're there, you know what I mean? And I'm thinking blue blood and a different, I don't know what I was thinking, but I mean, I'm there, you know, what do I want? And the next day in the papers, there was this shot of me looking at her like this, what is the baddie thinking of Princess Diana? And that was all over the place. And little did I know it was on closed circuit television. And people were laughing. My wife, who was then my girlfriend, said to me, what was going on? She says, we saw you looking her over. You know, so I think that was... it was actually innocent, but it looked real lecherous.
Take his arm. Would have a signature gun.
James Bond. This is the property of Her Majesty's government. How did you get it?
Piss off. Who ordered you to kill Sanchez?
No one. He's a rogue agent. I've got orders to take him back one way or the other.
We're Hong Kong narcotics, you bastard! Sanchez is taking us to the heart of his operations. I've been setting it up for years. Just hope that little stunt of yours hasn't scared him off.
Get me out of these bloody things. No, Commander. You're a loose cannon on deck. I'm shipping you straight back to London.
No! Come on!
Fuego.
Don't let them take you alive.
Si, mi coronel.
Now back to Robert Davi and his memories of Benicio del Toro.
Benicio del Toro. Benicio, I had an immediate affection for Benicio, I think a mutual affection. And we spent that whole time, that whole 5 months, really inseparable, laughing and cavorting. And I sensed in him, like a younger brother, that was the relationship with Dario that I felt it would be fun to create and stuff. And he has a tremendous talent, and I saw it then. And I think John Glenn did too. Because there was I remember a couple of readings that Benicio gave that a director may question them, you know. And John was very open to the quirkiness. Like when he says, nice honeymoon, he does something with the honeymoon thing, which was a very quirky kind of reading that shows you right there the choices, you know, and just a small little snippet of something. The actor's potential in his choices. He's, you know, great passion, loves his work. I loved working with him and loved being a friend of his. We later on did another film with John Glenn, Columbus, where we spent time in Malta, 3 months in Malta in the Virgin Islands. So we had another blast.
The James Bond films have always been renowned for putting their money on the screen. John Glenn remembers that despite the production value and the creature comforts of working on a Bond film, everyone on the crew worked to keep the costs down.
When you look at the what we used to make those films for in those days, you know, I think License to Kill, from Your Eyes Only to License to Kill, spanned about 12 years. And I think for Your Eyes Only, it was cost $27 million. And I think 12 years later, License to Kill cost $32 million. So we kept our costs pretty much under control. You know, economics come into a great deal when you plan a film. And I thought we were doing a pretty good job.
The scene shot at Villa Arabesque included a first for a James Bond film, a villain wearing pink. Robert Davi remembers.
I think that was outside. Great place, too. The Count and Countess de Portanova. Ricky and Sandy de Portanova, Sandra de Portanova, were friends of the Broccoli's. And the place where we shot Sanchez is where the pool is and where I meet Bond, and he's kidnapped. There was a place called Arabesque in Acapulco, which was a great, great place, huge, like 12 master bedrooms with their own little swimming pool, and then that big place, and, so we shot that there, that sequence there, where I wear the pink shirt. It was great. Everyone talked about Sanchez's wardrobe, and it was funny. They had great, that's what I was saying about the Broccoli's, they loved that stuff, you know. And I could pull off a pink shirt. I mean, I'm not going to be any less the guy for it. And even if I wasn't, who cares? But that wardrobe was those gushy Yoji Yamamoto shirts, and we dyed some of those pink.
Villa Arabesque, home of Baron Enrico de Portanova, a personal friend of Cubby Broccoli's, provided a unique location for License to Kill, as John Glenn recalls.
We stayed there, Cubby and I stayed there for a weekend. And if you put a shirt down, you look around, it was gone, as though by magic. And then an hour later, it would arrive, beautifully pressed, and placed in your wardrobe. I mean, he had, I think, a staff of about 20 people there, and there was no one but Cubby and I in the house. And of course, Cubby was a great tipper. And at the end of our stay, you know, they all lined up, and Cubby went along and gave them a tip each. You know, but 20 people, it would have been cheaper to go and stay in the most expensive hotel. But it was a fabulous location, and the Baron was very kind to us, although he did, while we were filming, he was in residence for a while. We didn't see too much of him, and, you know, when the helicopters came in and all his beautiful palm trees and all his plants were being blown all over the place, he was still very good about it. What they had there, which was absolutely wonderful, was an elevator that went down to the beach. And, of course, I had to use that in the movie. So this is what I was saying about when you write the script, you see these places and you have to work these scenes into the story. And, you know, Michael and I, we worked together, and very closely, and we managed to get all this stuff in.
Actor Robert Davi also has particularly fond memories of shooting at the Indian-style alabaster-walled location in Acapulco.
It's near Las Brisas, which is up on the hill there, and this is a little, I forget exactly the geography, but it's a tremendous place, and I remember staying up late at night with Ricky de Portanova, drinking some white wine, and having some great cigars, and Covey being there, you know. Not as long as I was, but it was fun. It was a fun time, you know. And like I said, that circuit, and they had that actual thing, that elevator thing that actually took you from the top of the mountain or to the villa. You know, that stuff was there, and when I had. I think Loopy goes up to betray me with Bond or something, two-timing Brett. But, yeah, that was a great place.
Senorita! Senorita! I'm going shopping. I won't be long.
Please don't come now. Senor Sanchez said.
Sometimes an actor's choices can prove difficult, as Carrie Lowell discovered when shooting this scene with Timothy Dalton.
That was a difficult scene, first of all, because I don't know why, but I had decided that I would be smoking a cigarette out of anxiety because I'm waiting for Bond to come, and I don't smoke, and so therefore I'm smoking this, and I get a complete head rush, and I'm sort of faint feeling. Then Timothy rushes in, pins me down on the bed with this gun, which is, he takes my own gun, which is strapped to my thigh, and he's got to reach down and get this out of my holster, because my character always wore her little gun on a black garter belt. And I don't know how many times Timothy went down there to get it and like fumbled out or it didn't come out, and so there was that. But then there was also, I was had so much exposition in that scene that I had to deliver under sort of an emotional duress moment where I'm talking about how somebody had these Stinger missiles and we were supposed to do this and I was going to give him a letter. I gave him a letter so that he could give it back to the government, but now Bond's ruined the whole thing and it's not about him, and it was just all this, and I'm supposed to be terrified, and I've missed it. It was just a loaded scene. There was so much going on and so much that had to be made clear because he thought I double-crossed him.
We don't have to.
Meet me at the Harbour Master's office in 2 hours. Bring the rolls down to the front of the hotel.
Yes, sir.
Ah, Senor Bond.
Senor Montelongo, I'm making a withdrawal.
Carrie Lowell remembers associate producer Barbara Broccoli's influence on License to Kill.
I think that she wanted to make her more contemporary and not just, she wasn't writing it, but I'm sure she had input. And her input and my input were very similar in that we both wanted her not to be sort of just an accoutrement on Bond's arm, but to be more of an action person, not just a sort of a piece of decoration. And I know there's a history of Bond women that are agents or are spies or are Russians or are whatever they are, biologists, anthropologists, geologists. They always seem to have this career, but they're always beautiful, extraordinary women. So it was trying to balance out those two things. So it wasn't just a beautiful woman that happened to be a whatever. It was trying to make that career or whatever the job that the woman had more evident, and that she actually seemed like that's really what she was, and she wasn't just given that title because it worked in the storyline.
Director John Glenn recalls filming this sequence in Key West.
We finished up crashing it into the dock. when he comes in, which was quite fun to shoot. You know, we constructed an extension to an existing dock, and the wave crest comes in under full power, and Kerry Lowell outwits the captain and manages to crash into the dock. And this, when it happened, was it was quite scary to see this this boat powering into us, but it did the job. Smashed up all of Peter Lamont's construction that he put in, you know, probably about 60 or 70 yards of docks and things and boats and all kinds of anything we could imagine that would create a spectacular scene.
Seem to be having a lot of problems lately.
Well, we had this crazy harbor pilot.
Let's talk about the money you owe me.
Why don't we talk inside?
Does he have a safe?
Not up here. Maybe below.
Have a look around. You have this right. He water skied behind the plane. Jumps on it.
No. He was, he threw the pilots out and flew away.
Like a little bird.
Kerry Lowell's flesh-colored bathing suit aroused concern for the costume designer, as Lowell remembers.
I do remember I had to wear a flesh sort of colored bathing suit. There's a scene when we take a boat into a harbor. We take Robert Davi has this boat that Anthony Zerbe is driving, and I run it into a dock or something, and I have to swim underwater and come out in this flesh colored suit. And the costumer was very concerned that the suit would be see-through. So she said, well, let's do a test. Cubby has said that we can come over to his house and you can swim in the pool. And when you come out, we'll see how it is. So I arrive at this beautiful, beautiful house in Beverly Hills. And Dana, his wife, was there. And Barbara was there. First, they served us iced tea. And it was just such a lovely home. And really had the feeling of a family there. And I took a swim in the pool, and the bathing suit was okay.
That's not my money. I swear.
That's right, Amigo. It's mine. You think I'm stupid?
Anthony Zerbe's character, Milton Crest, comes to an inglorious end in this scene. The exploding latex head was too realistic for censors, who demanded that cuts be made to keep the film within the confines of a PG-13 rating. Director John Glenn remembers.
And we made a mask of Anthony Zerbe's face, and made out of latex. And John Richardson, special effects man, demonstrated this head to me, what happens in a depressurization chamber if it all goes wrong. And he demonstrated it, and the head blew up and popped. And it was the most extraordinary thing I think I've ever seen. And it was, and in the final film, it was so realistic, the censor made us cut it to a minimum. But it was really scary to watch.
Many of the film's most humorous lines are uttered by its villain, Robert Davi.
What about the money, Patron?
Well, I think that, you know, I remember the essence of the Bond films. And Sean Connery always had those one-liners, you know, and Dirty Harry always had those one-liners. And I think for some reason, from my recollection, it may be wrong, I don't think Timothy wanted to have some of those kind of moments. You know, he thought they were a bit trite, maybe, or whatever. I don't know for sure. I think I knew it one time, but I remember feeling that even though he may not, I said, good, I'll take them to myself, because you know, with Terminator and all these other films, those are lines you remember, you know, and if the circumstance works out, you know. And like I said, that laundrette line, you know, I mean, and I remember the audience enjoying that. There was another one, Time to Start Killing Overhead, when the guy is the accountant. Anthony Starr keeps talking about, you know, cut back Sanchez on this and that. Yeah, well, get rid of him, you know. So there were a lot of... I thought it was good because that kind of guy would have that kind of cynical, you know, sense of humor. I thought it was right for the character.
After License to Kill premiered, Robert Davi was sent on a worldwide publicity tour by the film's producers. Davi was unable to curb his penchant for pranks, much to Barbara Broccoli and Michael Wilson's chagrin.
Probably more so when I went on the Bond tour for publicity. I gave them more of a... When I called my limo driver in Rome from Australia, and they had heard about it and were upset. The film was supposed to open in Rome, and his name was Walter, and so I wanted to find out how the film did, you know? So, I don't know. I became friends with the guy. You know, so I thought second nature, you know. Here I'm on this Bond tour for 5.5 months, 4 months, going around the world, which was amazing, by the way. That's like, you know, you feel like you're Tom Cruise for that period of time. Because all over the world, you know, the Bond films have such a huge publicity machine. Over 17 years of, or more than that, doing the Bonds. So each territory, Norway, Sweden, Denmark, Japan, Australia, you know, you clicked in right away. And tremendous... great suites at these hotels. I mean, it spoils you. Someone told me before I did the Bond film that they said that this experience, you'll never have another one like it in your life, as with a Bond film. And this is, I guess, when Cubby was alive. So, you know, I don't know how it is now, but that's how it was. That's how it was. It was, you know, I'm sure the big films do it, but not quite. I remember Arnold Schwarzenegger telling me, I believe it's a true story, but when the Bond film came out in Germany or in Austria, I think he told me his mom said, how come you don't do big movies like that? You know, because the publicity of the Bond machine. And Arnold had done huge movies at that point. Now, he may have been teasing me, but I think it... You know, judging from that whole way that was worked and the hotel suites that went on for days with butler service. I'm a kid from Long Island, and now I'm exposed to, you know, the creme de la creme hotels and all expenses paid, and that was great. That was worth the price of admission for me.
He's checking up on him.
Before becoming an actress, Carrie Lowell was a much-in-demand model.
I left modeling basically because I had an audition for a film called Club Paradise. It was the first film I ever did, and we went to Jamaica for 2 months, and I was surrounded by some of the most talented and funny people I had ever met. They were mostly from Second City and Saturday Night Live, and Harold Ramis was the director. We had Robin Williams and Twiggy and just a wonderful cast, and I had a wonderful experience, and I thought, this is the way to make a living. I would much rather do this, and luckily I was able to make a living at it.
Carrie Lowell recalls her audition for the role of CIA agent Pam Bouvier.
Jane Jenkins and Janet Hershenson were the casting people on this film, and I was told that she was a tough CIA agent who hangs out in a bar. So I showed up in jeans and a leather jacket, and I thought, this is my idea of tough. And Jane took one look at me and said, you know, where's your short skirt? This is a Bond film. How are you going to get the part in that? So she said, come back on Monday. It was a Friday. Come back on Monday, and we'll put you on tape then.
Carrie Lowell reveals her secret when it comes to winning roles.
I was a literature major at NYU. I still have not completed my degree. In fact, it's sort of the story of my life, in that every time I sign up for a course and I pay the money, I get a job. It's sort of Murphy's Law that once I've made my goal to be that, something else comes along. And, of course, I always take the work. I always figure I can go to school, but it happened most recently. I was going to take a documentary filmmaking course, And I'd paid my tuition, and I had signed up, and I had to go through all these somersaults to get admitted into the program, because it's a very difficult program, and had interviews with people. And finally, I'm going to start on Monday, and on Friday, I get an audition for a television show called Law and Order, and I went to Los Angeles, read for the network, and the next day, I had the job, and I had to go back and stand in line at the bursar's office at NYU and get my money refunded. It's a very odd, it happens to me all the time. The moment I make the decision to go to school. So if I ever want work, I'll just go to NYU and sign up.
The Mexican Tourist Authority told filmmakers about a location called Otomi, which, like Arabesque, seemed custom-built for Bond. Carrie Lowell remembers.
I do remember we all were sort of going on this adventure, because we were going to a location that wasn't sort of like the locations that we had been at. It wasn't in a major city. It didn't have sort of the availability of like restaurants and stuff. We were put in this hotel, which was okay. The food was okay. And we drove an hour from that place up to this odd, I don't know what to call it. It was like a stadium. It was like a big stone. I think it had been a ceremonial center for the local Mexican Indians, that they would go there and have, I'm not sure if it was sort of fairs or religious ceremonies or any cultural thing that they had going, that seemed to be the location for it. And it was just in the middle of nowhere, up in these mountains. And I don't know how they found it. Definitely served our purposes, because it was a bizarre place for Wayne Newton's religious cult to reside. That's where the little meditation room was. But I do remember that they had some of the most beautiful carpets that we would drive by every day on the way to. We'd go through this little village, and they had these beautiful carpets laying out, and we'd drive by every day up to this location. And finally, we all got out, and everybody went home with a carpet. I think half the people on the crew have a carpet from that area.
The special effects crew and art department enhanced Otomi with the use of clever foreground miniatures, as John Glenn explains.
You remember the shot of the helicopter coming in and the floor of the concourse opening up and the helicopter disappears down into the temple. We did that there with using a foreground miniature for the door. Worked absolutely perfectly. It was Michael Lamont drew it up. Michael Lamont was the production designer. He's the brother of Peter Lamont. And Neil Lamont, I think, worked on it as well. And they constructed it in scale so that it actually, you would never know. I mean, you look at it and you wonder. And there's nothing electronic about it. It's all done for real.
The rising hatch at Otomi allowed the filmmakers to create the illusion of a helicopter landing deep within the bowels of the complex, when in fact, it simply landed on the ground behind the miniature. Robert Dobby remembers watching the crew film the helicopter effect.
It was built kind of like a semi-dual thing there. I forget the intrigue about it, but there was some kind of intrigue about it that the guy who built it, or the president of Mexico who built it, his brother-in-law was a construction guy and cement guy, and there was some whole dual purpose of why the hell did they have this out in the middle of nowhere, this cultural arts center that no one was really using. I mean, I remember some vague story about that place, but it didn't have that lid. You know, that lid there that you see coming up. I mean, they built this whole other thing. That it had, and I don't. That was more Wayne Newton's domain. That's where his character was hiding out and staying and stuff like that.
Wayne Newton provided comic relief in *License to Kill* as Professor Joe Butcher, a character inspired by the spate of scandals involving television evangelists throughout the 1980s. Born in Roanoke, Virginia in 1942, Newton, who is part Native American, was a musical prodigy at age six. In 1963, Newton recorded the single, Donkashane, produced by pop idol Bobby Darin. The song became Newton's signature theme. In the late 1970s, Newton adopted the persona of Mr. Excitement and set his sights on Las Vegas. Within a decade, he became the undisputed king of Las Vegas showmen. Once listed in the Guinness Book of World Records as the world's highest paid entertainer, Newton's nightclub act regularly grosses over $1 million a month. At the time of License to Kill, Newton owned the Aladdin Casino in Las Vegas and an Arabian horse ranch that included a swimming pool for the horses.
Where is it?
Carrie Lowell remembers acting opposite Mr. Excitement.
Wayne was immaculate. Wayne would appear in the mornings either all in black with a white belt and white loafers, or all in white with black loafers and a black belt. His face was perfect, his hair was perfect, and then he'd go into hair and makeup and wardrobe. He was such a kind guy. I mean, he was like, he's like this boy trapped in a man's body. He was like, so how are you? And very, like, just sort of down-home kind of guy. And I remember after that, we probably wrapped right before Thanksgiving, and I got 2 dozen beautiful red roses for Christmas after that. And you just said red rose, or Dankeschön, or something like that. Dankeschön, darling. It was really sweet. It was a really sweet gesture. He was very able to make a joke about himself, be self-deprecating. I mean, the whole thing is that it's Wayne Newton, you know, and I'm like, oh, Reverend. He was perfect because he was slick and he was sort of tongue-in-cheek. He played it tongue-in-cheek because he knew that it was a joke. It's like knowing who you are and not being threatened by people's making fun of you. But sweet, and he had a woman there that he was engaged to. This really beautiful girl, and I don't know what happened. I don't know that they got married. I'm not sure, but he had his whole crowd with him. He was very happy. He seemed to be happy. I mean, he seemed to be very comfortable in his own skin.
Take the bankers with us. Wait a minute. The setup costs us $32 million. We have to try and save it. I don't give a shit about the setup. We got $500 million in the case and 20 tons of Colombian pure in the bankers. Now go, Havana.
But we have a deal with the Orientals. We've got their money.
I said go help Heller.
Now, do you want to make this hard or easy? Put him in the conveyor.
When you're up to your ankles, you're gonna beg to tell me everything. When you're up to your knees, you'll kiss my ass to kill you.
Actress Carrie Lowell remembers Benicio del Toro's intensity.
Benicio. He was very into realistic acting, so like when he had the knife, he had to be really careful because you weren't really sure if he was gonna use it. I remember he cut Timothy's hand. There's a scene when Timothy is going down this conveyor belt with cocaine chunks. It's supposed to go into this grinder thing, and his hands are bound like this, and he comes over the top, and he's supposed to hook onto this little hook, and Timothy's hanging there from this thing like this. It can't be comfortable, and Benicio is supposed to cut the strap that's holding him on this so he'll fall into the pit, and Benicio goes like this and slices Timothy's hand. We had to cut, and Timothy had to get stitched up. And Benicio was mortified, and Timothy was really wonderful about it. Said, it's okay, don't worry about it, I'll be okay. But please, next time you have the knife, be careful. You know, we're acting here. This isn't real life. So everybody sort of calmed down after that.
Of course, there's always an element of risk involved in shooting action scenes, particularly when they include sharp weapons. Benicio del Toro vividly remembers the onset accident.
We're doing a scene where I'm cutting a rope and he's hanging on this conveyor belt, and we were using a real knife, and we rehearsed it, but not with his, not really, you know, we were rehearsing it a little bit and it looked okay, so we were ready to shoot. And we did the take, and the knife just, as I cut it, it cut the wire really fast because it was actual weight I was pulling down. So as he grabbed to the edge of the conveyor belt, the knife cut his finger, like, really bad. And I remember feeling terrible about it. And maybe he went into the infirmary room. We were in Mexico, and so he went in there. And an hour later, he was back working. You know, a real pro. And you know, a good man to work with. You know. He still has a scar. You know, I saw him not too long ago, and he still has that scar on his finger. It's pretty funny.
Part of performing in an action film is learning how to realistically handle action props. Despite firearms training from stunt coordinator Paul Weston, Kerry Lowell found it difficult to fire a pistol without flinching.
I probably should have prepared more to be a CIA agent, because when they gave me the guns to shoot, I had never handled a gun before, and they were giving me half blanks, half loads, which is less than a full load. A full load makes a lot of noise and it's big, and so they gave me half loads, and they had me shooting on the back lot, and I kept going like that. I was like, shoot it and go like that. And I was just getting familiarized with the guns, but when it came to doing the scene, I have to come in and shoot Benicio as he's cutting James off of the conveyor belt, and I kept going like that. And John Glenn says, cut, cut. Kerry, you are a CIA agent. You shoot guns all the time. You don't flinch when you shoot a gun. I want you to hold the gun like this, keep your eyes open, and just, so I'm trying like this. But it was a funny moment, because you don't think about that stuff, you know. It's you have to do it with force, you know. Like, you do this all the time.
The grand finale of License to Kill is the tanker chase sequence, which was supervised by associate producer Barbara Broccoli. John Glenn remembers Broccoli's involvement.
The truck sequence at the end was a monster sequence to shoot. Arthur Worcester was heavily involved with that, as was Barbara Broccoli, who was running the admin of it. You know, she was producing that part of the film. I went down there for about a week with the main actors and shot close shots of Timothy and did stuff on these trucks, which was pretty hair-raising stuff, because they're very unforgiving, these vehicles, when they get rolling. I mean, they don't stop quickly. And we were using a section of road at on the border between the US and Mexico. We had to find about 16 tankers, because we needed all kinds of tankers. We needed sort of prop tankers for blowing up. We needed tankers that were performed for Remy Julian to do his two-wheelers with a tanker, which takes a bit of doing. And we had rockets being fired at the tanker, and then the tanker goes up on two wheels to miss the rocket and things like that. It was such an intricate... It's a very long scene, actually. It's about a 20-minute action sequence, and it's action-packed. There's something different happening all the time. So what I did was Barbara Broccoli, Cubby's daughter, took a unit down to Mexicali, which is quite close to where they actually make those vehicles, which was very useful because we could get the constantly repaired by the factory there. And we shot in the desert there and up on the Rumorosa Road, which was a disused section of mountain road, which was so dangerous that they bypassed it. And we actually used the 3-mile stretch, which was absolutely wonderful for our purposes. Although everyone told us, the locals told us it was haunted, which could account for a few of the accidents we had, but... on one occasion, one of the trucks went off the road, and the French driver, he leapt into the back, into the sleeping compartment, and he was able to save his life. He went down the mountain, and he survived by being in the sleeping compartment.
Benicio del Toro has fond memories of Barbara Broccoli.
Barbara Broccoli, you know, greatest laugh in Hollywood. She has a great laugh. She brings this element of, like, mother-like to... to the Bond films. It's just like she really cares about the actors, everybody involved. You know, she's kind of like the superhero of the films. You know, she really like she's really cares from, you know, for the movies and the people involved. And you know, I think that, you know, it's like I think that I got the job because of her, you know, so I'm very grateful to her. We're still friends. And in Hollywood, you know, you know, I did this film, 11 years ago or something like that, and it's hard when you like work on a film that you're still in touch with people that you worked on a film 11 years ago, you know, and I'm still in touch with her and really respect her a lot.
David Hedison echoes Benicio del Toro's sentiments.
She's a sweetheart. She's a lovely girl. I one thing I remember about her is she had the most wonderful laugh. She'd laugh, and the room would come alive. She was just lovely.
Supervising the driving stunts was Remy Julien. John Glenn recalls the famed French stunt driver.
In the film, the shot of the truck that does an eight-wheel wheelie, which had never been achieved before, to my knowledge, was actually done for real, although we'd made arrangements to have a rig made that would put the vehicle on its side. In fact, the French driver that we had managed to do it without the assistance of any rigs. Unbelievable to get an eight-wheeler to go on one set of wheels only on one side of the truck. Remember, that's where he does that to escape the rocket attack.
Memorable theme songs are a staple of the James Bond series. License to Kill's main theme was sung by Gladys Knight. The end theme, If You Ask Me To, sung by Patti LaBelle, later became a chart topper for Celine Dion. John Glenn talks about the music.
You know, on a Bond film, one expects to... It's a huge tradition of having a leading song, you know, at the beginning, mainly at the beginning, which you repeat usually at the end. You know, we've had Tom Jones, and we've had... Shirley Bassey's done about two or three, I think she's done, and, you know, Lulu. We've had so many wonderful singers. And we try and choose someone who's really... come up is fresh. Usually there have been some notable exceptions, but you know, you try and keep up with the times and get someone that's right up to the minute. And I think with License to Kill, we went to someone we know who had a wonderful voice, and we had a ballad which was unusual at that time, shall we say. Ballads weren't in, were they? They were considered the old hat, I think. So we had Gladys Knight, and then we had Patti LaBelle sing the, which I thought was a wonderful song, at the end of the movie. And I think later on got a lot of plays. Certainly I heard it a lot in America.
Thank you.
John Glenn has an affinity for visual humor, even in his action sequences, as he explains.
Talking of humor in the Bond movies, there's a lot of visual humor in my films. I sort of specialize in it, if you like. But I remember we worked in a scene during the truck chase where one of the pursuers' jeep crashes off of the road, and the aeroplane is flying by. Now, everyone knows there's nothing for an aeroplane to fly over a car. But if you reverse it, the car flies over the aeroplane, then you have humor. And I think that explains it pretty well in a Bond movie.
Capturing all the amazing stunts and the actors' performances on film is only part of the challenge of making a James Bond adventure. Next comes editing, where all the diverse pieces, shot over many months and in several locations in different countries, are joined together to create a seamless whole. Assuming, of course, that one has all the pieces, John Glenn talks about License to Kill's post-production.
Post-production for License to Kill was done at Pima Studios. We upped from Mexico City. I was there for 7 months, and we came back to the UK and got cracking on the post-production, because we had to, although all the shooting was complete, we had very tight release dates. So once we got back here, our usual sound crews got cracking, and I came back here and did most of the editing, although we had in fact done quite a lot of editing abroad. We packed all the film up in boxes, brought it all the way back. Some of the negative had been processed in Miami. When we got to neg cutting, someone said, "Oh, there's a shot missing, we can't find the negative." And we traced it to Miami, get that piece of negative back to England pronto, you know.
Here, stunt doubles were used for the wide shots. Robert Davi recalls how the actors managed to get in on the action.
Anything that was, you know, not death-worthy. Obviously, when it tips over, we're not there. But otherwise, yeah, those things were going, those trucks were going, and we were hanging out here and hanging out there and swinging a sword this way or machete that way. And yeah, that was, you know, anything that wasn't life-threatening. Like a little, you know, you like a little danger. Like an e-ticket ride at Disneyland.
Robert Davi remembers stunt coordinator Paul Weston's involvement with the actors for this physically demanding scene.
Paul Weston, I remember him and Timothy very similar, and you know, I was surprised to see the similarities in their physique and the look, you know, sort of perfect stuntman for him. And Paul, safety was always first. He had a great sense of humor. I just remember his ultimate professionalism and his joy. That whole English stunt crew, you know, all a bunch of great guys, as were camera and the whole crew.
Yes, sir.
I'll be up to see you next week. We'll do some fishing.
Good. I'll be out by then. M called.
He tried to reach you. I think he may have a job for you.
Look, Felix, I have to go. My hostess has just arrived.
Take care, Jim.
Bye. I thought you hated that thing.
Don't you know? Iguana's our girl's best friend.
In her final scene of License to Kill, Carrie Lowell faced more challenges than just crying on cue, as she recalls.
We had this scene, and it was the tag of the movie. It was the very end. And I'm wearing this blue sort of chiffon dress, and I see Timothy kissing Talisa Soto, and I run off crying. I was so sad. And I was really trying to cry, you know, and I thought, I was like, God, actors hate to cry, or some people love it, but it's always like, oh, God, am I going to be able to cry at the time it's supposed to happen? And I'm sitting there working toward, and his direction to me is, could you get the dress to just flow a bit more? Could you get it to billow a bit more in the wind? And I was like, what? That's it? Okay. So then that was, you know, that was the major concern. Then that was easy.
Actors appearing in a Bond film enter an elite pantheon, Kerry Lowell recalls.
I'm part of the legacy, and I didn't really appreciate that when I went in the pink dress, you know. And now it's I should give that pink dress to someplace.
Benicio del Toro reflects on his experiences.
Someone would have asked me, you know, when I was in high school, you know, that you in about 5 years you'll be playing in a Bond film. I would have never believed them. It was like, you know, almost like a dream come true. One of the few films that I've had fun, you know, from the beginning to the end, you know, it's like, it was a great memory, you know. So, you know, I hold very, very, very true to, very close to my heart.
I would like to thank director John Glenn and all the actors from License to Kill who are heard on this audio commentary. Kerry Lowell, Robert Davi, Benicio del Toro, Desmond Llewellyn, and David Hedison. I would also like to pay tribute to those who helped gather this material, particularly Mark Cowan, Lee Pfeiffer, Mark Cerulli, Paul Scrabo, George A. Mueller, and those at the Ian Fleming Foundation Archives. This audio commentary was compiled by Bruce Sively and produced by Bruce Sively and David Naylor. This is John Cork of the Ian Fleming Foundation.
Stay here.